Good morning. Welcome to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Each weekday morning, the Roundtable's Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from this week's shows. On Wednesday, August 6th, Joe was joined by Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin, Diplomat in Residence at Bard College, Ambassador Frederick Hoff, and Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson.
Ambassador Hoff just returned from Lebanon, and he talked a little bit about the work that he was doing. And then there's the story about a weakened Hezbollah resists pressure to give up its weapons. The Lebanese militant group has lost much of its power since the recent war in Israel, but it is balking at demands to surrender whatever is left of its once formidable arsenal. And this story just from yesterday, and I'm interested in getting your perspective on that and overall the situation in Lebanon.
Sure. And I should state at the outset, just for the record, I'm not a U.S. official. Last time I was in government was in 2012. And going to Lebanon and eventually Israel is not some kind of a secret mission. I just got back from Beirut after a week plus of some very intensive and interesting discussions with former senior Lebanese officials, former senior military officers, centering on the issues of what really needs to be done to pacify relations with Israel so that both countries can avoid violence, eventually move toward peace, so that Lebanese who have had to flee southern Lebanon can return to their homes, and Israelis who have been displaced from northern Israel can return home. This is something that's known as Track 2 diplomacy. It's an effort at the strictly unofficial level to do the homework on issues that are not yet being discussed in detail at the official level. I'm working with a former Canadian diplomat who recruited me to this thing, and we're focusing on a potential Israel-Lebanon armistice and on territorial disputes between the two countries. But while we were there, while we talked to all these people, we heard a lot about the issue of Hezbollah disarmament, which is something being discussed at the official level. For over 40 years, Iran built up Hezbollah as its political military proxy in Lebanon. It built it up to the point where it was eventually far superior in military capabilities to the Lebanese army. It could even stand up to Israel in 2000. Mm-hmm. It succeeded in ending Israel's occupation of southern Lebanon in 2006. It fought Israel to a bloody draw in a war that lasted several weeks. But in 2023, October 2023, it made what may prove to have been a fatal mistake. A day after the Hamas atrocities in Israel, Hezbollah began firing rockets into northern Israel. And this caused about 80,000 Israelis to flee from their homes. Israel's military response took several forms, but the bottom line is clear. Hezbollah was defeated decisively, and its charismatic leader, Hassan Nasrallah, was assassinated. Today, Hezbollah is, militarily speaking, a shell of what it once was, but it still has a lot of political support in Lebanon's dispossessed Shia community, and it's still heavily armed. Despite a ceasefire that was reached last year, Israel continues to hit Hezbollah personnel and positions, almost on a daily basis. Lebanon has a new president, a fella named Joseph Aoun, who used to command the army, who has pledged to establish an arms monopoly for the Lebanese state. And I must say, this is one of those things that's a lot easier said than done. Hezbollah says it wants to stay armed until Israeli attacks stop and until Israeli forces evacuate their positions in southern Lebanon. Israel says it's not going to stop these things until Hezbollah disarms. The United States and Saudi Arabia are saying at the official level that Lebanon will not get a dime in reconstruction aid until Hezbollah disarms. So we have a really complex chicken and egg situation here.
Fred, for our listeners, though, could you say a few sentences about the issue of the Saudi Arabia versus Iran and the role that the Shiite-Sunni conflict fits there, too?
Sure. Saudi Arabia, you know, Hezbollah's constituents in Lebanon.
He's taking requests.
Are almost entirely Shia Muslims. Saudi Arabia considers itself to be the leader of the Sunni Muslim world. Now, Saudi Arabia and Iran have reached a bit of a detente, but Saudi Arabia is also very, very interested in seeing Hezbollah in Lebanon completely erased, at least as a military force. Yesterday, the Lebanese cabinet met and told the Lebanese army, go and develop a plan to disarm Hezbollah by the end of 2025. This will probably disappoint both the Saudis and our own government in terms of being too slow. Figuratively speaking, they want to see Hezbollah disarmed in the next 20 minutes. But no one with whom we spoke in Lebanon wants to see a renewed Lebanese civil war, obviously. And no one we spoke with is absolutely sure that the Lebanese army would prevail over Hezbollah if push comes to shove. So, you know, in conclusion, one way forward is to try to consolidate the ceasefire in southern Lebanon, where Hezbollah, in fact, has been almost completely marginalized. Lebanese troops can replace Israeli soldiers in a kind of a step-by-step process. The two countries can begin armistice negotiations. Israel could pause its airstrikes for a period of time. These are the kinds of ideas my Canadian partner in this thing and I are trying to develop in detail as we speak with well-connected Israelis and Lebanese, trying to find if in fact there's a basis to move forward that would be mutually satisfactory to both countries.
When it comes to the situation that you're looking at overall, how, as you're having your discussions and especially having your discussions with Canada, how do you even discuss or the level of understanding of what the Israeli position is and what the United States position is? I mean, I assume you have to take that at its face value, and yet still there's a lot there you don't know.
Yeah, there's stuff we don't know across the board. I mean, both my Canadian colleague and I have worked on these issues literally for decades. But it's one of these classic situations where you know, the more you learn, the more you realize that you don't know everything. Our job is to gather information here, not to come in with a prescription, not to come in with our cure for what ails Lebanon and Israel. We're in the information gathering business. and we hope to come up with some ideas that we can pass on to the U.S. government and to anybody else who's interested in mediating this thing at the official level. But our only official connection in this to date. While I was in Beirut, my Canadian colleague and I were able to visit with the American ambassador, just to make sure that in our discussions we were not unintentionally trampling on something that was happening at the official level, and she told us no. Go ahead, full speed ahead. Let us know what you find out.
That's fascinating to me, because at a time when the State Department is being shrunk again, which happened under the first Trump administration, I'm curious as to whether this government, it's just curious to me that this government wouldn't be or feel threatened by your presence and your work. Especially,
yeah, we're not seeing that so far, and this kind of activity takes place, really in all administrations, regardless of the.
That was going to be my next
regardless
question.
Regardless of the State Department, the idea is that sometimes there are issues that are just so sensitive, just so difficult that the official level, official diplomatic exchanges haven't gotten to the point where they can be addressed. And this is an opportunity for people at the unofficial level to meet with former officials, former military officers, people who are well connected to their own governments, and put these issues on the table and have, you know, frank discussions just to see if ideas can come up out of this that can be fed into the official system.
So I think
over the years this track two approach has produced some good results.
Right. I was going to say I know that happens in the legal spaces on a human rights level, where you have these unofficial conversations that lead to the formation of on-the-ground type positive activities that create change from the ground up. And so I was wondering if that worked the same. And I'm going to say something that's not very popular, because I know we get a lot of letters on this, but this is really like the benefit of that professional class that Trump hates. You know, the so-called professional elites working in academia and government. This is real work that impacts people's everyday lives that you just don't see a lot in the news media, because you can't talk about it as much.
It's a great point.
It's a really important point. In having someone of Fred's stature and capability, he can go in and have conversations that the diplomats can't. I mean, because he doesn't have to worry about sort of representing the pride of the country or the insults, and you know, are considered different. I'd also note, Joe, that you know, we've had many, many conversations about USAID and this idea of foreign aid, and it strikes me that this is a prime example of. We've taken a chess piece off the board, our own chess piece off the board, by eliminating humanitarian and other aid that could be used as an incentive for Lebanon to further look at de-escalation of the situation between Hezbollah and Israel, but also standing up their own. Their own government, and this is where we've really weakened ourselves. And when you take years of experience out of the civil service, out of the bureaucracy, out of the trained diplomatic corps, in addition to taking the aid out, you know, we've really hamstrung ourselves. The other thing that I'll toss on, so people understand how complex the work that Fred's doing is, you have the situation of this isn't just Israel versus Hezbollah. You have the situation of Hezbollah versus you have the Muslim versus the Catholic, the Christian. So you've got sectarian issues between Christians in Lebanon and the Muslim world, but then you have the Sunni versus Shiite conflict, and then you have Israel. It takes an awful lot to be able to start to pull those knots apart in order to get even people to talk to each other. So the idea of informally being able to go in and say, "Hey, what would it take to be able to do this?"
No, listen, in our discussions, for example, with Lebanese Shia, okay, and I have not reached out to Hezbollah for discussions, and I don't think I will. I think there are American laws that that impact there. But Lebanese Shia, with whom we spoke, a former general, Lebanese Army general, a former senior official, they wanted to make it clear how vulnerable Lebanese Shia feel at this point. We're talking at about a third of the population, generally speaking, at the poorer end of the economic scale in Lebanon. They look at what's going on in Syria, okay, with violence being directed at some Syrian minorities. They wonder if they're next, okay? They wonder if, from the point of their own survival, does it make sense for Hezbollah to disarm at this point? Okay, and this is just an example of how complex it is. The Lebanese president, who is a Catholic, has reached out to the Shia community and said, "Please, please, stay with me on this." The Lebanese state, the Lebanese army, will protect you, will see to your welfare. All right. The Lebanese state is broke. There is no money. The United States has been consistently supportive of the Lebanese army, and this is very, 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 very important. Okay? But as much as I would like to see Hezbollah disarmed, I mean, Hezbollah is responsible for the violent, terrible deaths of a couple of friends of mine. Okay, as much as I want to see these people put out of business permanently, I can understand the average Lebanese Shia saying, "Wow, if they're disarmed, what happens to me?"
And Joe, this is also where I really push back against this whole idea of this gross misuse of tariffs as well, because part of what the United States can bring to the table as we start to think about trying to create a more lasting peace in Lebanon are trade deals that give the Lebanese markets an opportunity to grow that frankly really don't impact our own markets, but it creates money that flows in, which creates jobs, which creates stability, which adds to peace in ways that Fred were talking about. But what the administration has done is that we've taken a lot of the tools that we have besides military off the table in ways that I think are going to cost us in the long term.
Let's see. We have about 3 minutes, and I have two letters here. First of all, Jerome says, "I want to take the time to mention how fortunate we are to have someone in Fred who is not 1, 2, or 3 degrees away from the negotiations, but right in the heart of it." Thank you to Joe, WAMC, and the panel that you bring on to discuss issues of the day. Wow, just wow. I was just thinking that as I was listening to Fred talk. Mm-hmm. Wow, just wow. Then we go to James, who has a question for Fred. Can anyone on the panel, Fred, please enlighten us where are Hamas and Hezbollah getting their weapons from? It would seem that they don't have the ability to manufacture their own rockets. So where are they getting their guns from, and who are the companies making money from selling them weapons? To solve this, maybe we should, quote, follow the money.
Yeah, Israel is armed principally by the United States. It also has a thriving domestic arms production market. Hamas got many of its arms down through the years from Iran. It also has some domestic production capabilities. One thing I discovered a long time ago, 25 years ago, when I was chief of staff of an international committee that was investigating why the Second Intifada, violent uprising, took place in Israel, and where Palestinian gunmen were getting arms from, and one of the things we discovered, one of the things we were told by Israeli law enforcement people, was that Israeli criminal elements were making money on some arms transfers as well.
That was Frederick Hoff on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, August 6th. We'll be back with more after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, August 7th, Joe was joined by public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, Judy Patrick, and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio.
Let's start with the Trump and Putin meeting plan. This is this is not a done deal yet, but it is. It seems to be in the works, and what comes out of it, I'm sure we'll be talking about it for days to come. It was unclear whether Putin offered Trump any concessions in exchange for a meeting, but it would be a significant win for Putin after weeks of Trump's verbal attacks. President Donald Trump intends to meet, quote, very soon with Russian President Vladimir Putin to discuss the war in Ukraine, the president said, adding that he believes, quote, there's a very good chance of reaching an agreement. It was unclear, however, whether Putin had offered any concessions to Trump in exchange for a meeting, which a White House official said could come as early as next week. A meeting between the two leaders would be a significant win for Putin after weeks of Trump's verbal attacks on him. Trump repeatedly has said that while he and Putin have good conversations, those are followed by renewed Russian attacks on Ukraine. Asked by reporters at a White House event if Putin had offered anything in return for the meeting this time, Trump offered no specifics, saying only that we've had very productive talks today. I've been disappointed before with this one, Trump noted, but he said we're having very serious talks right now about getting it settled, getting it ended. I assume the "it" in this case is the ongoing war with Ukraine. Trump's openness to meeting with Putin came after a meeting earlier in the day in Moscow between Putin and the president's special envoy, Steve Witkoff. In an interview on Fox Business, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said that as a result of Witkoff's meeting, I think for the first time, quote, Perhaps since the administration began, we have some concrete examples of the kinds of things that Russia would ask for in order to end the war. Now, they may not be the conditions Ukraine can accept, or frankly, that others would accept, but at least we have something to work off of. I've always said this, if there's going to be a deal to end the war, it will have to require the president to come in at the end and close the deal. That from Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Judy.
Right. That's the point I think that Secretary of State Rubio is making, is the president typically comes in at the end, but it seems like we're at the beginning of whatever negotiations are going on. Certainly, we all want that war to end, but I want that war to end on Ukraine's terms. And it seems to me that when Trump meets with Putin, it does give, elevates his standing in the world community. You know, he met with the North Korean leader and the world didn't come to an end. So there's that. But at this point, I just believe that Putin is the one who's sitting in the catbird seat.
Robert.
I'm going to betray my utter lack of sophistication about, you know, diplomacy and statecraft here. I always find it kind of curious when the response to stories like this is, well, who is this good for? Is this good for Trump? Is it good for Putin, et cetera? You know, Judy, I tend to agree with you. Is it good for Ukraine is kind of where my head's at. And if Trump in his Trumpian style, you know, wanting to negotiate face to face, if that's what gets a deal done, I'm not going to pretend to look askance at that. Let's see what happens.
When I heard this news last night and listened to him talking about Trump talking about it, all I could think of was Infrastructure Week in the first term, his first term, where it was always going to be Infrastructure Week, but it was never Infrastructure Week. So, you know, that there's about to be a meeting with Putin. There has been about to be a meeting with Putin since he came to office, right? This one seems like maybe it's closer to actually being real. But it does worry me that I think Trump comes to this at this moment in more of a position of weakness, in that domestically he's got a lot going on. Certainly the Epstein issues with his base is an entanglement that he can't seem to steer his way through. The tariffs situation is a he's celebrating it, but I think it's more of an economic problem. There's the whole litany of things that are going on. His poll numbers are down. I'm no Russian expert for sure, but it just seems to me that Putin has the upper hand here. I did, you read the quotes from Marco Rubio, Secretary Rubio, Joe, yes. And that did really, those did stand out to me. Because he says, for the first time since the administration began, concrete examples. Well, didn't Trump, even during the campaign, when he said he would get the deal done in the first day, seem to be all but giving up everything for Ukraine, basically giving up Ukraine's bargaining position? And I think it's been pretty clear for a long time what the Russians want, both in their words and their actions. They want to keep the territory that they had in Crimea, and they want more. And so I didn't really understand Rubio's comments seem so not aligned with the reality of what we've heard Russia be clear about what they want. So that didn't make any sense to me. It also worries me that the NATO allies are not in this conversation, and they need to be, given the impact of these decisions on them. And unlike previous presidents, Republican and Democrat, that they would be part of the discussion. They don't seem to be. At least it appears that President Zelensky might be part of the discussion, so that helps. But overall, the key question, I think, is what concessions is Trump willing to make? And for Putin, is this just a tactic to both deflect and deter from the sanctions that he is really concerned about, particularly the oil sales.
You know, there's some talk that Putin is facing some domestic pressure because the war has gone out, or their military action has gone on for so long, and that maybe he is indeed under pressure to capitulate. But, I mean, acquiring that part of Ukraine is such an important part of who he is that it's hard to believe that after all the blood and gold that he's expended on this Ukraine invasion that he would give it up. I also think he's watched President Trump, and he's watched him, you know, keep relenting on deadlines and keep, you know, he's a deal maker, but when push comes to shove, he always, you know, caves in. Trump does. I mean, it's from past experience. Putin is a sly guy.
Well, that's, yeah, and the sale of Russian oil, right, that's a big thing for Putin, and these tariffs would be, and so it just seems that the timing is strategic for Putin and not good for Trump. And it's also interesting, as the experts have pointed out, that Trump says, well, he's going to do these indirect sanctions, including on India, for higher tariffs because they're purchasing Russian oil. But the Chinese are purchasing far more Russian oil, and he's not making a similar threat to the Chinese.
The other thing I wonder is, when we hear in the past, I'm not being cynical, I'm just asking the question, but when we hear these meetings, that the phone meetings that go on for 2-3 mm-hmm. hours, what is coming out of those, and where do we see any concrete information, which leads us to the question of, do the dynamics substantially change when the two are in the same room?
This was my point, Joe, when I was, you know, standing on the ground of lack of sophistication on statecraft and diplomacy. I mean, and the article in the New York Times is all about this. You know, what are the preconditions? You know, typically there's not a face-to-face until aides have met for months. So, you know, in other words, it's kind of like the thing with prosecutors. Don't ask the question that you don't know what the answer is going to be. I guess that's the way that we practice statecraft, you know, historically. Trump doesn't do that. Sure, okay, maybe that's a problem. But at this point, I have a difficult time seeing why there would be a problem with starting with the ceasefire, if that's what you get. And then you can come in and negotiate all these other aspects. In other words, it doesn't make sense to me, Teresa, to say, well, it elevates Putin until or unless all these other conditions are met. You know, again, if that makes me unsophisticated, I'll own it. Let's get the ceasefire and then negotiate the shape of the table after.
No, I was just going to say, put your hand over your heart. But I listen to a lot of satellite radio, and they have these. How should I describe them? I'll try to do it as nicely as possible. These fly by night organizations that have advertising on there, but they will always say, past performance might be an indicator of future performance, and that seems to be the case here. Like, I keep hearing that tagline over and over again.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, different presidents can do it differently. But the meeting, a face-to-face meeting with the president was typically meaning the signing of a deal, not the negotiating of a deal.
Right.
And so I think that there is a difference between them talking on the phone and a face-to-face meeting. I always also thought it was interesting, they just announced when I was on the way, and that the location will probably be in the Middle East, UAE, as opposed to somewhere in Europe or something like that, which I thought is that Trump's now, I think because he has so much business there, I don't know, seems to be that's where he heads. But I thought location, because the location usually has a meaning. But a ceasefire is an important goal, but does it lock in the land right now which they're currently holding, because the Russians in the last few weeks have had intensive fighting and taken more land.
We are talking about the Trump and Putin plan to meet on Ukraine, and the fact that a Zelensky meeting could follow. I found that aspect of this interesting, too. after the failed, disastrous, awkward, however, whatever word you want to say, the meeting that took place between Volodymyr Zelensky and President Trump in the Oval Office several months ago.
Embarrassingly rude.
That we'll add that to the list. That you could, the big question was how much input was Zelensky and ultimately Ukraine going to have in these ongoing discussions? So here we have a meeting that is going to begin with that of between the United States and Russia, and only was sort of dangling the carrot that later on after those meetings are done that Zelensky and Ukraine could be involved, which has been a sticking point for Zelensky since the very beginning of all this.
But didn't he have a call with Zelensky, or at least Rubio did in the last few days?
And they had that tete-a-tete in Vatican City at the Pope's funeral that, from all reports, was very productive from the Ukrainian side of things. You know, it could be the same thing of whoever Trump talks to last is the person who has the most sway. So Zelensky's actually doing a good thing by being the second person to talk to him.
And I also think once Zelensky made the deal with him on access to the rare earth minerals that Ukraine has, I think that cheered Trump up a bit.
You know, I'm hoping for a ceasefire would be good, but what we really need there is a permanent peace. And I think that's what all of Europe is looking for, is some sort of, you know, way to not have to worry about Russia invading, you know, countries that do not belong to them.
Rolling through Ukraine and into Poland, right. And then just keep going.
Since, Judy and Teresa, you are clearly better informed on this issue than I am, I'm earnestly curious about this question. What if you were in a position to advise, I'm not going to say Trump or Rubio, a president that you preferred on resolving this conflict to maintain or to advance U.S. interests, what would your advice be?
Well, at some point, Ukraine has to be in a good bargaining position.
That's a high bar.
Yeah, it is. It is. And Putin has to be treated like the invader that he is. I think treating this like a just measure or action by the Russian nation is wrong. I think it needs to be turned around the other way. I don't think there really is a good way to negotiate with Putin. Something has to be done, but people are far smarter than Donald Trump need to get involved.
Well, you're kind of anticipating my point, or at least my curiosity, because it feels to me like what we're implying here is that there is not a diplomatic solution here, that it is only a military solution.
No, not at all.
Then what's the diplomatic solution you prefer?
Get NATO more
exactly
involved.
Exactly right.
This is not a Russia U.S. conflict. This is more a European conflict or a NATO conflict, and it's a NATO problem, and it needs to have a long-term NATO solution. And I think Europe, what I hear from my friends who live in Europe is that they need to stand together. They need to stand together when it comes to tariffs. They need to stand together to support democracy. They need to stand together in so many respects when it comes to dealing with Russia and now dealing with the United States. And I think they can be powerful.
That was Judy Patrick on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, August 7th. We'll be back with more of the Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, August 8th, Joe was joined by EPA Regional Administrator, Professor at Bennington College and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pacitti, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel.
Here we begin to talk about it, which is led by Trump, Republicans push to redraw election maps in new states, this according to the Washington Post. This all comes out of the story, of course, in Texas. At least that's where it began. Republicans are exploring ways to redraw congressional maps in their favor well beyond Texas as President Donald Trump pushes for aggressive changes, worrying that some in his party who have little appetite for an escalating redistricting war with Democrats. The White House has been driving the GOP redistricting effort, according to people familiar with the process, some of whom spoke on the condition of anonymity. Republicans are discussing ways to create new red seats in Missouri and Indiana and Ohio ahead of next year's midterm elections and carve out as many as five in the state of Florida, even as they face legal hurdles. A White House spokesman said that staffers have not drawn any maps. John McLaughlin, one of Trump's pollsters, said the president doesn't want to risk facing Democratic-led investigations, as he previously did, if the party retakes control of Congress. After everything he's been through, I don't think he wants to leave anything to chance that would allow his opponents to do what they did to him in the first term and in the subsequent years. Some elected Republicans are skeptical of the push to redraw, concerned about Democratic retaliation in blue states, and hesitant to shake up longstanding lines. In GOP-controlled Indiana, where Vice President J.D. Vance met Thursday with state leaders and discussed redistricting, many Republican state lawmakers are unenthusiastic about the idea, according to a GOP legislator who spoke without giving his name so he could describe these private conversations. And is that what? And then he went to Ohio and raised the river?
I think he raised the river before he went to Ohio.
Okay. He wanted to take a boat ride. Mm-hmm. The river was a little low, so they dammed it up, and they raised the river, and so he could get a better view.
What's the point of being the vice president if you can't just make rivers flow when you want?
I don't know.
It's like the opposite of parting the seas or something.
Well, right. And right. If you raise it higher, it's more visible when Trump just walks across the water.
Yeah, I think these guys are just so arrogant. They don't think anyone at the Army right. Corps of Engineers is ever going to share this information, and they're just going to set themselves up for future problems.
Well, let's begin with you, Judith Enck, regarding the redistricting and what it looks like in Texas and beyond.
Well, this may seem like a dorky inside baseball good government debate. It is so serious because I think it's part of a three-prong effort by the Trump administration to do everything possible, both legal and illegal, to make sure that they hold the House in the midterms. So first, we see the redistricting, and we'll get into that. Second, they're going to push for redoing the census earlier than usual, and they're going to be working overtime to make sure that where there's a cluster of Democratic voters that they don't let people register for the census. And then third, they're going to go after and have been going after voting rights. So, you know, one at a time, the redistricting, look, it is a mess even without the influence of King Trump. In New York, you know, they have an independent redistricting commission, but you have districts that, you know, look very oddly shaped. The Democrats are always looking for an advantage, as are the Republicans.
You go in, you take the either the silly putty or the Play-Doh, and you take it out of the color is your choice. Take it out of the container, you put it in your hand, and then you just squeeze. And as it oozes out, and then you put it down, you say, oh, that's our district.
The, that's one way to describe it. But there's
I mean, that's what they look like.
Yeah, because they're looking to have political party advantage.
Right.
And redistricting is a problem. Full stop. Now, what they're trying to do in
and
Texas.
And both parties.
Yes,
do it.
Both. Absolutely.
Yes.
And that's why you have good government groups saying we really need to do an independent redistricting process based on math, based on making sure there's enough minority representation. This has been a problem for years. But this is now a problem on steroids. And it's starting in Texas where Trump has contacted Governor Greg Abbott and said he is nervous about the Democrats picking up more seats. So change the districts, you know, like eliminate Jasmine Crockett's district entirely. And what I find really interesting is we think of Texas as primarily a Republican bastion. It wasn't long ago that Ann Richards was the governor of Texas.
Well, 94?
Yeah. So it was long ago.
Yeah.
But I looked up the numbers. In terms of enrollment of registered voters, there are more Democrats than Republicans in Texas. Dems are 46.5%. Republicans are 40%. And unaffiliated, 15.5%. So I've always had the perception that, you know, the Republicans were in total control in Texas. In fact, there are far more registered Democrats than Republicans. So they are trying to redistrict in the middle of all of this. As you know, the Democrats have fled the state. This is not the first time they've done this. Ironically, the special session, which lasts 30 days, was called to deal with the horrible aftermath of the flooding in Texas. And then Governor Abbott is trying to sneak in redistricting. So I think the Democrats that are in the Democratic legislature, the Democratic minority in the legislature, have done the right thing. They fled the state. Now there's talk of the FBI pursuing them. And remember, who's the head of the FBI? Kash Patel, not exactly a model of good government. I don't think these legislators have done anything criminal, but yet they're trying to intimidate them by having the FBI go after them. And there are 54 of these state legislators that have left their families. Some of them are doing constant media, so it's not like they're in hiding. And, you know, if the FBI tries to find them in Illinois, like outside of a TV studio, it won't be hard to find them. I think these legislators seem very determined not to facilitate this, and they can head to Mexico or Canada.
There you go, Aaron Bassetti.
It's clear at this point that the Trump administration is going to pursue nothing is off limits, nothing is out of bounds. We're going to break every norm that existed before to preserve power. And I think there's two reasons for that. One is a personality and psychological issue of this is a person who just wants to dominate and instill fear upon anyone who is not with him. The second one, which I think is more important to the rest of the population, is that he's imposing a lot of policies that are affecting a lot of people in a lot of different ways, and they are wildly unpopular, whether it's the tariffs raising the cost of a household budget by $3,000 a year, whether it's cutting Medicaid, whether it's making Social Security benefits harder to get, that when you impose these unpopular policies, you're going to have some angry voters, perhaps some from your own party. So a normal, sane, rational politician would say, well, maybe it's the policies that are the problem, and we should figure out how to change them to attract more voters. This is not what's happening. These are policies that almost exclusively benefit the richest 1% of the population, and you can't win an election with 1% of the vote. So what you do is you just redraw the maps to enhance your power. So you don't change the policies that are causing the problem. You change the maps so that you can get more representation in otherwise competitive districts. The easiest way to think about redrawing these maps really turns the whole concept of democracy on its head, where instead of letting voters choose their leaders, we have leaders choosing who their voters are. And this creates an enormous existential problem to how democracy functions. So in terms of a democratic strategy, you can't bring a knife to a gunfight. I know this is wildly unpopular, but if Republicans are going to do it, then I think Democrats need to engage in the same tactics wherever available, so that when 2026 rolls around, they at least have a fighting chance of reclaiming the House.
Nick Rangel.
Ooh, man. I hate to say it, but this has been the path of the conservative right-leaning camp for a very long time. They've been intentionally dismantling the Voting Rights Act that required a formula approach in Section 5 that would require the courts to review the racial impact of voting, of changes to election laws and practices. That legislation, along with other legislation, requires an evaluation of majority-minority districts, voting districts, to allow the consolidation of voting blocks, and has been the subject of litigation for a long time. And you know, the right has tried to dismantle that. They have had several significant wins at the Supreme Court, striking down those various provisions or certain provisions in the Voting Rights Act over the last, like, 10 or 15 years. And I think this is just the next step of what that looks like. If there is no oversight of redistricting maps and there is no accountability for how maps water down the strength of voting blocks, not just Democrat and Republican, but voting blocks around racial lines, particularly in states that have long histories of Jim Crow laws and discrimination in voting rights, you see this tendency to claim that it's about Democrat votes, but in reality is truly about diminishing the voting power of BIPOC voters. And in Texas, as we were just talking about, where there are there is a high rate of Democratic voters, Hispanic voters are shifting to the right, particularly in states like Texas. And these redistricting maps would also diminish their voting power, even though they are voting and increasingly voting Republican, because it's not just about Republican Democrat. It's also about racial majorities having a voice in their local elections. And I think we have to keep that lens as an overlay that, you know, the racial inequality is ultimately kind of the premise behind whether the majority is a Republican or Democratic Party.
When you think of what we're going through in the redistricting in the states, and as the Democrats get involved in this too, and how far they want to go, it does seem like this has been a kerfuffle this week, but we are running out of time. And TikTok, I mean, even in New York, the time's passed, right?
Oh, yeah. In New York, you'd have to do a constitutional amendment.
Which lost last time.
Yeah. So it has to pass the legislature, I think, two consecutive sessions. Yeah. You would know, Nick, and then go to the voters. And so what Governor Hochul is proposing would not affect the midterms.
Yeah, I think her timeline at the earliest could put redistricting at 2027 as opposed to 2030, which is still a little earlier than the 10-year census cycle, but not by much.
I think what Governor Hochul is doing on redistricting is mostly performative, because it's not going to affect the midterms, but she stakes out a position of, you know, standing up to Greg Abbott. I think some of the other Democratic states probably have a more likelihood of affecting the midterms. And this is really calling into question Michelle Obama's direction to when they go low, we go high, which I never subscribe to. But this is really a moment where are you standing up for the integrity of an independent redistricting process, or are you being politically realistic? And if Texas is going to, you know, throw the rules out and just draw lines that favor Republican districts, why wouldn't Democratic governors and Democratic state legislatures do the same thing to benefit Democrats? And the stakes could not be higher. I mean, I think what we're seeing this because Trump is way down in the polls. Now, theoretically, he's not running again, but he does not want Democrats controlling the majority in either House or governor's races. And this is a pickle, and it also distracts from Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, it distracts from a million things, right? The tariffs that are increasing costs and extracting wealth from average Americans while the wealthiest people are getting these tremendous tax cuts. And, I mean, there's so many.
Yeah.
There's so many like bigger
things.
What's interesting is if the Republicans are successful in gaining more House seats, what – first off – you know, redistricting at the state and legislative level is not the only recourse that voters have, right? The Democratic turnout in Texas in the last election was shockingly bad. I mean, just really abysmal. It had been one of the lowest Democratic turnouts in Texas in years. They did not come out to vote. So if I am a Texas resident and I am a voter and I am looking at the continued diminishing of my voter, the weight of my vote, right? Like the value of my vote. I'm doing something. I'm protesting. I'm writing to electeds. I'm getting people to change their voter registration. I'm engaging. We're not seeing that, which I find terrifying. That it, you know, it does really feel like the analogy of the frog in the boiling water. Like, why are voters not more angry and more upset that they are losing their voice through this administrative practice, this like legislative, you know, back and forth? Like, it doesn't matter that Governor Hochul can't change the district maps in New York State until 2027 if Texas voters are just going to cede their rights before that, right? The other piece, I guess, is that the most significant aspects of the reconciliation bill won't take effect until after the midterms. And I think as the midterms come closer, I think people should and hopefully will become more outraged by the impact that that bill is going to have on them. And in the fall this year, assuming that the House can pass anything, we're likely to see massive cuts in other programs like my program, legal services, victim services, human services across the board. But the protests are not happening at the rate and the size and the the majority that they need to for there to be right for there to be like a response by lawmakers. Like, they're out there yelling, they're only yelling, but like what are we doing? Like, what are we doing broadly speaking?
That was Nick Rangel on the Roundtable panel on Friday, August 8th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Madeline Reynolds. Thank you for listening.